From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made 150 years ago today. The world was learning the news that American President Abraham Lincoln had been murdered, assassinated by a racist actor named John Wilkes Booth. Booth had taken advantage of lax security at the Ford Theater, shooting the president in the back of the head before fleeing. 150 years ago today, Lincoln was dead, Booth remained on the run. Well, this week, there was a vigil outside the old Ford Theater in Washington. Costumed reenactors set the scene as closely as they could to that terrible evening, an evening that stretched into the morning hours before the president passed away. This hour, we examine a number of questions about the man who might have been our country's greatest president, with a man who has written a wonderful book that looks into what made Abraham Lincoln so effective, so good at what he did, and so valuable to us even today. Joseph Fornieri is a professor of political science at the Rochester Institute of Technology and the director of the Center for Statesmanship, Law, and Liberty, and the author of Abraham Lincoln, Philosopher-Statesman. Great to have you. Thanks for being here.
Oh, it's a real pleasure. Thank you for having me here.
Well, your book, which we're really going to delve into for much of the hour, takes us into why you call him a philosopher-statesman. And, you know, this being 150 years to the week that we lost the president, a lot of people are sort of, I think understandably, talking about fixated on that night, the manhunt, Booth. We're not going to get too much into that this hour. We're going to talk about what made Lincoln a philosopher-statesman, but that's a great place to start. Why do you call him a philosopher-statesman?
I think that we're interested in Lincoln because of his greatness. His greatness in saving the Union, his greatness in defining the American dream and ending slavery. And so in this book, I explore, you know, really what constitutes that greatness. And I believe it was a combination of greatness of thought. Lincoln was a man of ideas. He possessed a great vision, a great intellect, and greatness of action, great deeds, great character. So thought and action united, and I think that's described in terms of a philosopher statesman.
Sometimes when we lose elected leaders, political leaders, in tragic ways, we tend toward hagiography, and I think that's probably a natural inclination. Lincoln, had he lived, had he survived that assassination attempt, or had Booth never made it to Lincoln, and had Lincoln lived into old age, I think your book is just more confirmation. He'd be considered one of the great presidents no matter how his life ended.
Oh, I appreciate that, and I think that's true, and I seek to show that this is not hagiography. Hagiography is the study of saints, of course.
Sure.
And, you know, there's concerns that you uncritically venerate someone of the past, and that's a perennial temptation. But at the same time, especially in, I think, culture today, we go to the opposite extreme, and we tear leaders down, we deconstruct leaders. We look at, you know, their flaws and maybe even magnify these flaws. I forthrightly argue that Lincoln is great, and this is why, and I provide sound arguments. I'm a political philosopher, so I don't, this book engages in analysis. It looks to the great thinkers like Aristotle and St. Thomas Aquinas for their insights and understanding Lincoln's greatness. So it's not simply a narrative. It's not simply storytelling. And that has its place. But my role and contribution, I think, is different.
How much time, if any, have you spent thinking about whether Lincoln could have been saved by modern medicine and how things would be different?
You know, I have thought of that. And again, I'm not one of our students at RIT. Works for the Department of, I'm sorry, works for the, I think it was the Department of the Army there, and he actually has photographed Booth's spine and Lincoln's skull. Boy, it made me think whether or not there was any possibility to save him. Yeah. From a layman's perspective, it looks pretty bad.
Yeah, I think that's right. Well, if you want to join the conversation with Joseph Fornieri, the author of Abraham Lincoln, Philosopher-Statesman, you can call the program this hour. It's 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Now, as I said, we're not going to fixate on the actual assassination, But I do want to shed some light on that question of what modern medicine might have done. Now, historians could debate about how the country would be different today, and certainly Reconstruction and many things after Lincoln's death would almost certainly have been very, very different. Reporter Jake Harper of NPR affiliate WFYI in Indianapolis asked that question that we've been kind of touching on this afternoon, which is, if Lincoln had at least been treated by modern medicine, would there have been a realistic chance to save him? Let's listen to Jake's report.
Mr. Trenchard, that you're not used to the manners of good society, and that alone will excuse the impertinence of which you have been guilty.
Don't know the manners of good society, eh? Well, I guess I know enough to turn you inside out, old gal. You sock-dologizing old man trap.
150 years ago, on the night of April 14th, 1865, President Abraham Lincoln sat in a box seat in Ford's Theater in Washington, D.C., and while he watched the play, he was also being watched. John Wilkes Booth was listening for the line that would elicit the biggest laugh of this show. He took aim at the back of Lincoln's head.
You sock-dologizing old man trap?
A lead ball rocketed out of Booth's pistol at 400 feet per second, and then it moved into the brain. The bullet sent shockwaves through the tissue, smaller and smaller, as it slowed down and came to rest. Lincoln slumped in his chair, unconscious, and his wife Mary held him upright and kept him from collapsing to the floor. A 23-year-old doctor named Charles Leal was 40 feet away when he heard the pistol. Shouts filled the air as he ran to the president's box, where a distraught Mrs. Lincoln begged him to help her husband. There wasn't much he could do. Medicine at the time just wasn't that advanced. But could modern medicine have saved Lincoln's life? To answer that question, I talked to an expert.
My name is Dr. Tom Scalia. I am the physician-in-chief at the R. Adams College Shock Trauma Center, University of Maryland.
Scalia presented on this topic several years ago at a conference after looking over the notes from Lincoln's doctors.
It's really remarkable when you read their account. They really had a pretty good understanding of what was going on, and they were very observant.
Throughout the night and into the morning, after the president was carried across the street, the physicians kept careful notes on the president's pulse and breathing.
11:10, pulse 45. 11:15, pulse 42.
They had nothing. They had physical exam. And they were very keenly aware of his physical findings and his responses. When they would probe the wound and blood would come out, he would transiently get better.
But why? Brain tissue is delicate and full of blood vessels. So after a trauma like a gunshot wound, it can swell and bleed.
In a vigorous man of Lincoln's age, the brain takes up all of the room in the skull, so there's no extra room. So you have hemorrhage and or swelling, and that, since there's no extra room, that just starts increasing the pressure.
If that intracranial pressure gets too high, it damages the brain and makes it hard for blood to get to the head. And without oxygen, the brain dies. So to reduce the pressure in the skull,
The custom at the time was to probe wounds. And they did that repeatedly to the president.
Lincoln lost a lot of blood. The doctors reported that the sheets in the bed, the pillows, and their own clothes were soaked. Probing was the only tool they had to reduce the pressure and stabilize Lincoln's vital signs. So they waited, probing when they needed to, and taking careful notes the whole night and into the morning.
7 o'clock. Pulse and respiration failing much. 7:22. Death close to the scene. He slept.
Obviously, 150 years later, trauma care is much more advanced, and there are actually techniques to address bleeding and pressure without probing into the brain. Scalia says that if Lincoln were shot today, the first step would be to get him as quickly as possible to a trauma center. Doctors would put in a tube to support his breathing, check his pulse and blood pressure, and look at his eyes to assess brain activity.
You then do what you can do to try to at least mitigate any further problems, and you might do that by giving him some hypertonic saline.
Hypertonic saline is basically just really salty water. Increasing the salt in the blood will make the tissues in the brain expel water and shrink.
And then with him, you get him to the CT scanner so that you can define the anatomy of his injury and see if there is any surgically repairable problem.
It's likely that a lot of pressure in Lincoln's skull is from what are called subdural hematomas. When the brain is injured, blood can get trapped and build up beneath the brain's outer layer. As Lincoln's brain bled more and more, those pockets of blood would have butted up against the walls of his skull and pressed on his brain.
There is no minimally invasive option here. If you want to drain that, those need to come out with an open operation.
A surgical team would be mobilized to perform a craniectomy. A part of Lincoln's skull would be removed, which helps relieve the pressure and allows doctors to drain the hematomas. With the bleeding under control, doctors would likely place pressure monitors in Lincoln's skull and get him to the ICU. And there, Lincoln would be carefully watched.
One of the observations of the physicians was how good a shape he was in. So he was a strong guy, and he was, certainly by modern standards, he wasn't very old. Now it's very possible that something else, infection would have set in, he would have had a different complication, who knows? But if you ask me, is this a survivable set of injuries, the answer is yes. Now, very complicated set of circumstances, very bad brain injury. It's, I think, highly likely that he would have some long-term neurologic deficits. The nice news here is that his frontal lobes apparently were spared, so his ability to think should have been intact. The kids do better than younger people do better than older people. It's not like the president was 20 years old, I get that part. But I do think that you kind of never know what's going to happen until you take a try at it.
Of course, if Lincoln were shot today, Booth would have used a much more powerful gun, which would have changed a lot about Lincoln's injury. Then again, if Booth tried to shoot Lincoln today, Lincoln's Secret Service agent would probably stop him instead of drinking at a nearby saloon, like Lincoln's guard was doing on the night of April 14th, 1865.
And that is Jake Harper of NPR affiliate WFYI in Indianapolis taking a look at the question, how would modern medicine have attempted to save Abraham Lincoln's life 150 years ago this week. Joseph Fornieri, when we look at the John Wilkes Booth story, Lincoln's last speech was, John Wilkes Booth had sort of, he'd been in Lincoln's midst a number of times leading up to that assassination. What was it about the last speech that maybe set Booth off, or did that change anything?
I think it certainly did, and you're right to say that he had been following Lincoln, almost stalking him. He appeared at Lincoln's second inaugural address, and had mentioned that he had an opportunity to kill him then. We have that documented. And subsequently, Lincoln's last speech that he gave, Booth was there. And what infuriated him was Lincoln's reference to black citizenship. And of course, Booth infamously says he means N-word citizenship. Yeah. That's the last speech he'll ever make. And that's what enraged Booth, and he carried that out, unfortunately.
Yeah, he did. We're talking to Joseph Fornieri, who is the author of Abraham Lincoln, Philosopher, Statesman. He's also a professor of political science at RIT and the director of the Center for Statesmanship, Law, and Liberty. We're going to talk about later this hour what that is and what that means. It's a relatively new endeavor, and we're going to kind of delve into some of that. But I want to read a couple of different portions of your work in the book about Lincoln as a philosopher statesman, because sometimes, Professor, when we think about political leaders, we'll look back on their actions and we'll say, well, what can we infer about their philosophy based on what they did? Whereas you show us just how much Lincoln was not just acting, but really thinking and thinking about history and thinking about different frameworks. And here you write in a section called Wisdom about how Lincoln was thinking about the word liberty. Not just in a way that we hear the word liberty and we all think we kind of know what it means. I want to read as you ascribe these words to Lincoln, and then I want to ask you a couple questions about it. This is Lincoln's own words about the meaning of liberty. Quote, "The world has never had a good definition of the word liberty, and the American people just now are much in want of one. We all declare for liberty, but in using the same word, we do not all mean the same thing. With some, the word liberty may mean for each man to do as he pleases with himself and the product of his labor, while with others, the same word may mean for some men to do as they please with other men and the product of other men's labor. Here are two not only different but incompatible things called by the same name, liberty, and it follows that each of things is, by the respective parties, called by two different and incompatible names, liberty and tyranny." So he's thinking about the fact that even when you use the word liberty at that time, people are taking it in different ways. I assume, and I think that you helped demonstrate that he was taking sides a little bit in that, but that was a fascinating passage to me.
You know, I have always loved that passage. I think it's wonderful that you cited it. I think it reveals the depth of Lincoln's mind. And of course, this is a public speech. He's stating this to the public, to a sanitary commission. The sanitary commission functioned much like the Red Cross at the time during the Civil War. Lincoln's musing about the meaning of liberty, and we still struggle over the meaning of freedom today, of liberty. He's factually correct. You know, certainly the South, if you were to ask what they were fighting for, they were fighting for the states' rights and the right of self-determination, free from government interference, the right to hold property in a slave, to move their chattel property from one place to another without government interference. That was one conception of freedom. The other conception was, of course, the right of every human being to enjoy the fruits of his or her own labor and not have them stolen. Lincoln points out that there are different opinions, just like today, different opinions on what liberty might mean. There are different opinions, but he also believes that reason has a role to play in this, and we can reveal, if you will, the contradiction of trying to harmonize slavery with freedom, because ultimately that's what it boiled down to. You know, it's freedom is the right to hold another person in slavery.
Right, and you point out then there is this complexity that happens when Southern slave owners kind of throw something back at Lincoln and those who they viewed as threatening their own liberty. And this was interesting to me because Lincoln is somebody who was very aware of the classics of ancient Greek and Roman philosophy and in many ways had a lot of appreciation and some of his own roots in that. And yet the Southern slave owners would say, well, go back to ancient Greece and Rome, and they own slaves too. We are modeling ourselves on that. You wrote that they were deft to do that.
Yes. That's, again, another good point. Lincoln's formal education amounted to no more than a year. And so he was self-taught, and the classics he read were primarily by way of Plutarch, which I highly recommend to the audience. I loved it as a kid. I love it now that I'm a little older. I like to teach it at RIT. These are the lives of the noble Greeks and Romans. So Lincoln turned to that as his source for much of ancient leadership. What we were saying about
the southern slave owners, they would point out, hey,
ancient Greece and Rome, you know, both had slaves. You know, you look at the cradle of democracy; it was based on slavery, as was Rome. And Southern apologists, the South enlisted some of its finest minds to defend and justify slavery. Today, we take for granted that democratic government and slavery are utterly incompatible, but to an extent, we pay our debt to Lincoln, who intellectually engaged those ideas and I think decisively defeated them. Some say that, you know, we applaud Lincoln today because the Union won on the battlefield. Might makes right. Well, I hope that's not the case. I think if it was a battle of ideas as well as a battle of bayonets.
You bring up a term that we often hear with Lincoln, which is pragmatist. And that's another term that maybe different people might use it in different ways. I think of pragmatism with Lincoln the same way that, and perhaps Steven Spielberg has something to do with this, and we'll ask Joseph what he thinks about Spielberg's work with Lincoln. But certainly there were the idea that Thaddeus Stevens and the Radical Republicans wanted something bold and declarative and firm in regards to slavery and abolition, whereas Lincoln might have been playing more of a longer game, that certainly he had ideas about what needed to happen and what inevitably would happen, but he understood the consequences of sort of a step-by-step approach as opposed to something a little bit more bold. And not that his work wasn't bold, but I think some people view pragmatism in Lincoln in that way. Do you?
I think the term pragmatism has different meanings, yeah. And I discuss this in the book. And it's not merely a matter of semantics, because when we teach Lincoln, we often will say that Lincoln was pragmatic. Or even I remember years back, the New York State Regents exam had a question. You know, Lincoln's goal in the Civil War was, you know, A, to save the Union, B, to free the slaves. And the proper choice was to save the Union. But it provides the impression that those two goals were incompatible. They
right.
were linked, and in Lincoln's mind, they were linked. And it conveys this message that Lincoln, as a politician, was an unprincipled horse trader, that he followed the waves and crests of public opinion. He was a good bargainer. Simply a salesperson. Now, there's no doubt that to be a good politician, you have to be able to sell your vision. There's no doubt that bargaining is important. But being a great statesman involves more. It means standing for something. And Lincoln stood for principle. I mean, he was willing to risk war rather than to compromise on the core principle of slavery extension. Before the war, he would not revoke the Emancipation Proclamation. So there were core principles there that he would not surrender. So I prefer, instead of the term
the either or
pragmatism, where mm-hmm. again, it's, you know, big on success, big on results, short on principle, is I think the way we most people understand pragmatism.
Which you say is unfair.
Yeah, I think it distorts. It distorts. But surely Lincoln's political genius did involve an ability to read people, an ability to negotiate, an ability to equivocate when necessary at times. But it wasn't exhausted by this. There's that larger picture of Lincoln as the principled individual who had, you know, a great vision of public life, and there were boundaries to his ambition and to expediency. I prefer the term prudence, which means I try to revive it from Aristotle and from Thomas Aquinas, for what it's worth, and say we should understand Lincoln as someone who possessed the virtue of practical wisdom, the ability to apply principles under the circumstances.
Do you cringe when you hear about teachers in on any level, middle school, high school, college level, asking that sort of either or, that was Lincoln interested in saving the Union or freeing the slaves? That sort of either or, does that bother you? Because once in a while that does come up and that framing comes up.
Yeah, I understand it. I can't be too critical. Because Lincoln himself, I think, equivocates. In his letter to Horace Greeley in August of 1862, he says, "My paramount object in this contest is to save the Union." So, but then if we read carefully, you know, if I save the Union by freeing none of the slaves, I would do it. If I would save the Union by freeing some of the slaves, I'd do it. if I would save the Union by freeing some and leaving others in slavery, I would do it. And of course, this is the alternative that he ultimately chooses, given the constitutional constraints. At the same time, there's an admission of a bombshell here. No president had ever claimed the authority to free the slaves. And Lincoln had already written a preliminary version of the Emancipation Proclamation. So when he says his paramount object, for those that have lived with Lincoln, and even borne out by his deeds as well as his speeches, it doesn't mean his sole or exclusive object, right? That it's linked. He had to bring the Democratic border slave states into the coalition, into the war coalition to defeat the South. So we had to be careful with his language in this regard. So part of the difficulty, I think, when we look at that disjunction is some of Lincoln's rhetoric, trying to be prudent.
Okay, but I also want to make sure I'm not conflating. I think of the words of William Seward, who was very nearly president, and then a Secretary of State, and Lincoln. And my understanding, Professor, and tell me if I'm wrong here, is that both Seward and Lincoln thought that in the end, certainly it mattered if there was emancipation, but in some sense it didn't matter if it was now or in 3 years or 5 years or in 10 years, because no union could survive long term with slavery. That they thought this will not last. We need to preserve the union because slavery is not long for this union anyway.
Well put. I would say not any union, right? It's preserving not any union. I don't think that Lincoln thought that the end of slavery was inevitable. It required sacrifice. It required living up to our highest aspirations in the Declaration of Independence. But preserving the type of union Lincoln believed in, mm-hmm. that is, a union dedicated to the principles of the Declaration and the rule of law and the Constitution. The picture of silver and the apple of gold. He uses a metaphor in the Psalms to describe the relationship between the Constitution and the Declaration. So preserving the union for Lincoln and for Seward here, I think more for Lincoln. Seward, I think, could slide into a certain pragmatism at times. For Lincoln, meant preserving the principles for which the Union stood. So that's where, if we wanted to, make some corrections in terms of preventing lapsing into the either or, preserving the Union for Lincoln always meant preserving a Union dedicated to universal freedom in the long term. But that also meant not retreating from the legal and moral right to restrict slavery in the territory and to place a moral blockade on the institution, even though we have to make some concessions to it.
All right, one question with a modern parallel then, because if I'm talking to the director of the Center for Statesmanship, Law, and Liberty at RIT, I'm going to ask about a modern parallel. I was reading Andrew Sullivan, a longtime British writer, sadly for me and many of his readers, wrapped up 15 years of blog writing a few months back. But he has chronicled the Obama administration, and Andrew Sullivan is a gay conservative who is a big Obama fan. And Sullivan defended Obama when it came to gay rights and same-sex marriage on the grounds that Obama is a Lincoln pragmatist. He said that Obama knew there would have to be a long game, that if he came into office in 2009 and said same-sex marriage, it's on the table, it's what I want, it would be viewed as too radical, too soon, too quick, that it was done under his watch, and he knew that step by step, incrementally, you can't try to, take the whole cake right off the bat. And Sullivan said, in the same way that Lincoln understood pragmatically, that abolition would come in steps, maybe not the way Thaddeus Stevens wanted. And I thought that was an interesting comparison, but I don't know if it's apt.
No, I think it is an interesting comparison, and I've always respected Andrew Sullivan's work and his mind. But I'll say this. It seemed that before the election, Obama was in principle against gay marriage.
Yeah, I agree. Right.
Okay, in principle.
And certainly by his public statements, yes.
Okay, and that subsequently, he changed. Now, there's a difference between saying, you're against something in principle, but then change, or saying, I think Lincoln was always in principle against slavery. He thought it was wrong. Now, but he was constrained by circumstances. I think it was different in Obama's case, mm-hmm. whether you're for or against ultimately what he did. I think that he certainly conveyed his principled opposition to gay marriage, and then
in a way that Lincoln never stood up and said, yes, I'm principally in favor
of
slavery.
Yeah, it'd be one thing to say that I see no, I don't think gay marriage is necessarily problematic. It's not, its public opinion won't support it at the moment. Mm-hmm. And our lodestone should be our guide, our principle should be the equality for all, regardless of gender. I didn't hear that before. If I heard that before, then I would say it was somewhat consistent with Lincoln.
Yeah, very interesting. Joseph Fornieri, my guest for the hour, the author of Abraham Lincoln, Philosopher, Statesman, a book about the core of what Abraham Lincoln's presidency and his own philosophy is about. And you heard him explain why he describes Abraham Lincoln as a philosopher statement. Joseph is also a professor of political science at RIT and the director of the Center for Statesmanship, Law, and Liberty there. Let's take a very short break, come back. We're going to find out whether we should keep... I think every now and then there's a big, either a book or a movie, and for at least a decade or two or three, it's what people often think about when they think about one person, a historical figure, et cetera. Should we look to Spielberg's work and be comfortable with that? We're going to find out what Joseph says about that. And we're going to learn more about what the Center for Statesmanship, Law, and Liberty is. It's all straight ahead on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, what is co-housing? We're going to talk to the co-founder of Eco Village at Ithaca. That's a co-housing community that's been around for more than 20 years, and now Rochester will get its own co-housing community. What is it all about? How do you live that way? What about meals, transportation, jobs? Those questions answered next hour as we talk co-housing on Connections.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from the Community Design Center, hosting a luncheon as part of the Reshaping Rochester series. Chris Coleman, St. Paul, Minnesota Mayor, and Tim Griffin speak on riverfront planning April 21st. Ticket information at cdcrochester.org.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. We're going to get to some of your questions that have come in on Twitter, at Evan Dawson, in just a few minutes. If you want to call the program with comments or questions about Lincoln, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. It is, of course, 150 years this week since the assassination of Abraham Lincoln, and 150 years ago today. Just remarkable to think about what was going on in this country, the manhunt for Booth, and the shockwaves of the news of Lincoln's death spreading across this country and then around the world. Joseph Fornieri, my guest, and a lot of the discussion on Lincoln in the last couple of years. 2012 was the Spielberg film. There was this flurry of Lincoln interest, 2011, 12, 13, which is always interesting to see why Hollywood or the public eye goes to a certain subject, but Lincoln certainly has had his moment recently in Hollywood. How does Spielberg do with it?
I have to admit, I loved it. Okay, I'm going to just be candid and forthright here. I know there's scholars who take issue with it, who will point out every historical misstep, but I'll tell you why I like it so much. I thought that Daniel Day-Lewis captured Lincoln's character. When I saw him perform Lincoln, he brought to life what I had envisioned about the man, and I say that honestly. His proneness to philosophical abstraction, Lewis caught, his compassion, his kindness. The suffering how Lincoln suffered. Now, there's a few things it's worth taking issue on. The bribery. Okay, there's no. I don't think they've proved that Lincoln had bribed, people for this. He certainly did, though, use patronage.
Sure.
He used patronage, but, the scene
we're talking about for the amendment.
Yeah, exactly. He certainly used patronage there were Democratic voters who didn't show up or abstain that day, and they were rewarded with government jobs. And Lincoln had reminded them of that. Also, the chicanery with you saw the meeting with the Confederates where Lincoln writes that note at a critical moment. That was true. As far as he slapped his son, I don't know any evidence of that, but it does capture the strain between Lincoln and his son.
So it sounds to me like it was, first of all, close enough on history without leading us astray on any major points, and it sounds like you just loved seeing what, in your own mind, looked like Lincoln would have been. And that's what Daniel Day-Lewis has been widely praised, I think rightfully so, for that.
I think you have to give credit to Sally Fields in her portrayal of Mary. Please forgive me now. I forget the actor who did Seward. I thought he was wonderful too. The whole cast of characters, mm-hmm. Even the guy who looks like he had a short cameo role who walks in and he's Alexander Stevens, the vice president of the Confederacy, looked just like him. So and I liked, some people didn't like, but I liked the way Spielberg focused on this one issue. Right, the enactment of the 13th Amendment, and that there was depth, as much as I think can be.
I'm going to get to the phones in just a second, and we had a question from a caller who did not want to be on the air, but Andy and Lima wanted to know if people in the South think positively about Lincoln as people in the North do, or is this opinion regional? I don't know if we can speak for entire swaths of the country. It's an interesting question. Do you have any insight into that?
It's a great question, and let me answer it this way. It's to an extent regional, because there are strong voices in the South, not all, but there are still strong voices who regard Lincoln as a tyrant. But we see that in the North in some circles too, who regard Lincoln as a tyrant. I had a professor where I was who referred to the war. The Civil War is the war of Northern aggression. He was a brilliant mind, and I respected him, but we disagreed on this topic. So I think there's always been, during his life and even today, a strong, believe it or not, anti-Lincoln tradition, and it lingers.
Patrick in Rochester has a question. He says, the South had no agricultural society and free labor. Now it seems that the manufacturing culture of today nearly has slavery in China. So he wants to know if there's a parallel between slavery in the South before the Civil War in this country and essentially what he perceives as slavery in China when it comes to manufacturing and the way products are made today.
Wow. I like that question.
It's heavy. Yeah.
It might be too strong to regard it as slavery, and I'm not going to venture a definite answer on this, but I will say, look, Lincoln believed in the right to strike, and insofar as the Chinese laborers have a right to organize and strike and compete for higher wages, and if there is an opportunity for them to advance, then I think Lincoln would applaud that system. If there's no opportunity to strike, if there's no opportunity for advancement, and they're being held down through coercion, then I think Lincoln would have been critical of it. So interestingly enough, Lincoln did defend the right to strike.
Janet wants to know what the professor thinks about subsequent leaders after Lincoln's death and how far they fell short as statesmen.
Oh, that's a great question, and here I could always. Get in some hot water, who's included and who's not included. As the director of the center, I try to remain nonpartisan. So I'm going to, let me just throw out a couple greats. I think one would have to consider at least Franklin Delano Roosevelt as a great leader who, restored confidence in the nation after the Great Depression. I know my family sung his praises greatly and this had a huge impression on me as a child. I'm not saying that FDR was flawless, but I think he would be a contender as a great transformative statesman. Truman, I think, is of late. I would put Eisenhower in the category as well, and perhaps Ronald Reagan as well for defeating communism, such.
Okay, and to Janet's question, I think she was indeed asking about all the subsequent presidents after Lincoln.
Oh, okay. Sorry about that.
I think you interpreted her question correctly. Now that I see it that way, I'm wondering if she's asking immediately following Lincoln's death, did the leadership fall short? Reconstruction, the way this nation ostensibly healed, and maybe what she seems to be asking is, with if Lincoln were still there, if he hadn't been assassinated, would his leadership, with his philosophical statesmanship, have changed the way the nation healed?
I think it would have. You know, I'm going to venture and say I think it would have been better, given what we know of his practical wisdom and how he handled obstacles during the war. Reconstruction was a tremendous challenge, and we had probably the worst president in one of the worst times in our history navigating that. That's
really
Johnson.
Johnson almost universally viewed as he's either the worst or among the bottom three, it seems.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. And, we have to mention something about Rochester Pride. Frederick Douglass had met with Johnson shortly after he became president. And it just contrasts so radically with how Johnson treated Douglass. Johnson insulted him compared to how Lincoln treated him. Lincoln and Douglass had met three times, and Douglass was struck by Lincoln's humanity and taking no consideration of his color. You couldn't say the same about Johnson. Johnson insulted him and made racist remarks, and this was just a foretaste of what was going to come.
Yeah, you wonder if people don't think of it this way or don't talk about it this way, but what regret there would be of Lincoln's choice of Johnson as a vice president, and if it had been William Seward or somebody else. Johnson, was he just not up to what history asked of him, his personal failings, maybe his own challenges? What do you think?
I think all of the above. I think he wasn't up to it intellectually. He didn't have the character. He didn't have the vision. He was someone who held grudges. I mean, compare Lincoln's second inaugural address with malice towards none, with charity for all. This is Lincoln's message at the end of the war, and he even goes so far as to say the prayers of both sides have not been fully answered, that there is some culpability on the part of the North for the national sin of slavery. This outraged some of the more self-righteous factions in the North, who were expecting a strong vindication of the North. Well, compare that to Andrew Johnson, who's one of his first words is treason must be made infamous. I mean, he was bent on punishing what he regarded as the slaveocracy, the slaveocracy there. And then at the same time, completely indifferent to the plight of African Americans, if not hostile, notwithstanding their sacrifice on the battlefield, which Lincoln deeply appreciated.
Talking to Joseph Fornieri, the author of Abraham Lincoln, Philosopher, Statesman, and he is also the director of the Center for Statesmanship, Law, and Liberty at RIT, which is how old now?
Well, we're only 2 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And this has been a dream of mine. I felt that it was needed, given the lack of statesmanship at all levels today, and I also felt that if we look at many of the competing programs in the country or even in the area, they teach leadership, and I think that's good. That has its place. But statesmanship is a distinct type of leadership, right? The leadership of a CEO does not translate exactly into the leadership of a statesman. So I want to try and keep statesmanship alive in theory and practice. I mean, we're fortunate that Lincoln had read the lives of you know, lives of George Washington and Plutarch's lives and was inspired by that. And we hope we can do the same for this generation. I mean, we talk about building leaders. I hope we are able to equip them with the skills to become responsible citizens as well as potential statesmen.
Okay, so the center will go about this in what ways? Take me through that, because some of what you're painting a picture for us is simply the way we start out teaching and assigning reading and making sure that there are awareness of texts and historical figures. Is that step one? What can we do?
Well, I certainly think that's an element of it, mm-hmm. and I'm all for emphasizing original texts, and I do believe in great texts. I think there are such a things. I also believe in individual greatness. I believe, you know, some would disagree, that history is not simply determined by circumstance or context, that ideas matter in history, principles matter, and that we can distinguish between great individuals who make a difference in our lives from those who are simply controlled, you know, by events. That's certainly part of it in terms of the pedagogy. What I want to do is engage the wider community in terms of some of the great issues of our times. We just had a symposium on balancing, reconciling liberty, security, and privacy in a post 9/11 world. And so we had our keynote speaker was Richard Clark. Yeah, mm-hmm. Richard Clark, mm-hmm. Who just authored the NSA report and was on the 9/11 commission. Mm-hmm. And we had different voices, different intellectual voices. So that's part of it. I also would like to engage students at the secondary level. I was a secondary teacher at Bishop Kearney. I loved it. I taught advanced placement, American and European history, as well as global studies. And I'd like to really work with secondary school teachers in tandem. We had an advanced placement day on Thursday and Friday. I'd like to provide some type of professional development opportunities for secondary teachers. I think we can learn a lot from each other. I certainly would say that I really learned the art of teaching by teaching at the secondary level in the classroom. And I love those kids. I love the experience. But I also love what I'm doing now, and in the university, of course, scholarship is a large part of the calling as well as teaching. So
all right,
I have both.
Give us a little bit of a homework assignment then, a text or two that we can read about leadership, statesmanship, that you love, that we should all read. You've mentioned Plutarch. Is he on the list?
Yeah, I would definitely put Plutarch on the list there. You know, I would include Aristotle's Politics or Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics, but that may be a little challenging without a guide. Harry Jaffa's work, The Crisis of the House Divided, is a great work.
And one more listener question. Sarah wants to know, why is the modern political discussion obsessed with, quote, American exceptionalism, end quote?
Yeah, this...
Got a whole other hour for that, I think.
Sarah is her name?
Sarah, yeah.
It's a great question. I you know, look, this exceptionalism is a strong strain that goes right back to the Puritans. It is part of, I think, our cultural inheritance, and I think it has both constructive and destructive tendencies. It could lapse into self-righteousness and jingoism, right? God has blessed us, and therefore anything we do, we're sanctioned by God. But it also has, I think, constructive tendencies, that imbues us with a sense of moral responsibility and hopefully critical self-reflection. That there's a standard we have to live up to, that we have to strive. We have to live up to these principles that we believe in. But of course, it takes great statesmen to point out these principles and the gap that exists between the ideal and the real.
The book is called Abraham Lincoln, Philosopher, Statesman by Joseph Fournieri, who's been my guest for the hour, a political science professor at the Rochester Institute of Technology and the director of the Center for Statesmanship, Law, and Liberty. It's been a great conversation, and I have to think that at the very least 150 years since we lost this great president, it must be moving to you to see all of the interest, to see that vigil outside the old Ford Theater and still the love for this president.
Want to keep the faith alive. Yeah. Keep the faith of our greatest statesman.
Well, I look forward to more conversations with you about the center and the work you're doing. And thanks for taking the time to join the program.
And thank you so much for the high level of discourse. Yeah. I really appreciate it, Evan.
Yeah, you're very kind. That's Joseph Fournieri. Short break. And we're coming back with a very different discussion next hour, trying to get our heads around what co-housing is and why Rochester wants to build more of it. That's next hour. Stay with us.